Clash number 12707, Captain Frank Brewis, reel 14.
Captain H.C.F. Brewis, Reel 14. What was about to happen to you in this particular situation, Captain Brewis?
Well, there were all sorts of rumours, wild rumours. But in the end, we found out that there was something in it. We didn't know at that stage that it was going to be a complete change of role. Anyway, 20th of September, 1942... we move to a tented and hutted camp. Well, more tented than hutted at that stage. At Lowther Park, near Penrith. Part of Lord Lonsdale's estate. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained. The whole place was an absolute quagmire. And we thought, what the heck have we come to here? Anyway, CO had everybody on parade on the football field a couple of days later. And we thought, oh, crikey, not again. We've trained as an infantry unit. We've done all our field firing, we've done long route marches, we've done long exercises, we've been a demonstration battalion of the company commander's school and all in command. We've packed that up, we've become an armoured unit. We have pretty well mastered the Churchill. And we think we could give a good account of ourselves now. What now? And we were told, first of all, that we were going to be trained to use some equipment that was on the top secret list. And we all had to get it into our heads that we would have to keep our eyes and ears open and our mouths shut. It was vital. He couldn't stress this strongly enough. That within the space of our arrival and our introduction to an entirely new conception in the use of tanks, we would have to be, we'd get used to censorship of our mail. Officers would have to undertake the task of censoring the men's mail. They would be put on their honour to censor their own mail, that they would, as to what they put in their letters to relatives and sweethearts and wives, and they would have to use their own censorship numbered stamp on the outside of their mail, which would be subject to outside censorship. So it was no use any officer thinking that he could drop any hints about what we were doing, marking it with his own stamp and getting away with it, because he would be immediately court-martialed if an outside censor opened his mail and found that he'd been cheating. That we would have blue cap military police, the vulnerable points people on guard in the camp, And so he didn't say it then, but I found out later. When I was temporarily at brigade headquarters and shared a room with an officer of the intelligence corps who had an incredible wardrobe of a variety of regiments and ranks, and he had people employed in Penrith as barmen, bus conductors, keeping an ear open for any loose talk. And then he went on to say that it was a top secret device mounted in a tank turret of special design for fighting tanks at night, that we would all go on training courses to the CDL school established in Lowther Castle. CDL, he said, meant Canal Defence Lights, but it really meant nothing at all. There were, I gathered later on, some units in the Middle East. And whether it was intended as a diversionary title and it was linked to the defence of the Suez Canal, it was a bit abstruse because they never dared switch on. They were up in Syria and the Lebanon, and the place was crawling with spies. And it had a drastic effect on us later on, but we'll come to that in due course. He didn't go into any details of the technicalities of this new device. He said we would learn all about that on training courses up at Lowther Castle. What we would see would be Matilda tanks. I thought, oh no, we start again learning something new. We didn't know at that stage that there would be Lees, Grants, Shermans, and then back to Churchill's again. However, and whenever these tanks were on public roads, the turret would be under a tarpaulin cover. It struck me afterwards, why go to all that bother without sticking a lump of telegraph pole also under a tarpaulin cover to make it look as though it was a tank with a gun? But what had struck Brewis apparently hadn't struck the powers that be. But it was absolutely laid down, no tank goes out of Lowther Park without its turret tarpaulin cover in place, and it will remain in place.
Had you left your Cromwell behind when you moved to Lowther?
Churchill,
sorry.
Yeah. Who did we hand them over to? Do you know, I can't remember. But I have a feeling I was away on yet another course. I have no memory of physically moving from Gurriton. I think I was away on a course of some sort.
Had you moved under the auspices of some particular division or unit?
The move to Penrith brought us under command of 35 independent tank brigade. I think some of us wondered just what the independent meant. This was before Daddy Heslop's talk to the whole regiment. because, you know, we thought it would be as we were in infantry, in a division, in a corps, etc., etc. But it became clear when he talked about special equipment for fighting tanks at night, and had gone on to say, you may gather from that that nobody's going to drive a tank around the countryside with only the light of its headlights. So it's a specialized, call it a searchlight if you like, but it's not like an AK-AK searchlight where small arms fire can put it out of action. And we thought, well, yeah, well, that's why it's an independent tank brigade. Under Brigadier de Lip, what was his full name? Humphrey Torrens de Boone Lipscomb. Got to know him very well later on when I went to brigade headquarters. Colonel Lipscomb was a regular Royal Tank Regiment officer of long experience and had obviously been given this command because all his regular career he'd been vastly interested and connected closely with tank development.
Was this the Lipscomb that you had the altercation with over the oil?
Oh, yeah. The brig, as we were called. Yeah. I had a few lumps bitten out of me on occasion by him. But on the other hand, we got on quite well. And at a later stage, he was very good to me. However, that's in the future. So, we started in batches going on the courses up to Lowther Castle. We started getting Churchills again. They were brought in by rail to somewhere south of Penrith. And I hadn't been near a tank for quite a number of months. And I found myself driving one off a rail flat car with the outer edges of the tracks overlapping the edges of the wagon. And we brought them into Lowther Camp and we tried to keep them away from the worst of the mud. We did have some, or by the time the tanks came, we had some hard standings made, concrete hard standings, up in the woods, hidden from the air, on the sides of the roads from this camp, which was near Eamont Bridge End, south of Penrith. This was on the road up to, through Lowther Park, up to Lord Lonsdale's seat, Lowther Castle. And most of the training was done in the stable yard and the outbuildings at the castle. I was one of the tail end Charlies. It was the front end folks, the troops in the squadrons who were to get the benefit of the first training courses. What was I doing then? Oh, I think I still had the scout troop. And in between I was doubling as assistant adjutant when Jeff Harris went on leave.
What form did the training take, the lecturing and so forth?
Well, the lecturing was minimal. Let me think back to when I went. can't remember the name of the commandant of the school. But they were either RTR instructors, and a few Remy bods thrown in as well. Gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Marcel Mitsakis. He is the man behind what you're going to see now. He is the inventor. He became interested before the war in this idea, along with, and the name's gone, regular tank regiment bod, Fuller?
There was a J.C. Fuller.
I think it was Fuller.
Expert.
Yeah. Way back about 1916, there'd been some thought given to fighting tanks at night, that would be as big a surprise as the first Battle of Cambrai and the first use of tanks in any form. But it never really got off the ground. Anyway, Mitsakis and Fuller, if I've got the name right, got their heads together, and they developed the first prototypes. It was developed, it was put up to the War Office, there was no interest. So they took it to the French government.
What time would this be?
Late 30s, I think. Middle or late 30s. The French showed some interest, and then the war box woke up and thought, there must be more to this than we originally thought. And the net result was that their interest resulted in Mitsakis being reapproached, and fortunately the French didn't get it, we got it. And as early as 1940, the War Office were actively engaged in bringing into being a training program and a production program for these specialized turrets, and making modifications to the heaviest tank that they had at the time, which is the Matilda. So then we were shown this funny looking thing without its tarpaulin cover. Where's the bloody gun? Well, gentlemen, you see that instead of a gun, on the flat face of this turret, shaping away to a more or less semicircular rear part of the turret, you'll see that there's a slit in the armour. Mutterings about no angled armour on this. Absolutely flat, straight up and down. You'll see that this slit in the turret is closed by a shutter. Obviously it's there to move. And when it's moved out of place, that is when things begin to happen. The turret is divided into two compartments, one where the operator will sit, and one where there is an arc light, which is visible through a very heavy dark blue screen from the operator's half of the turret, and it's driven by a subsidiary generator, and that produces a light of 13 million candle power. And at night, through that slot, it will throw a beam of light of that intensity about 320 or 350, I think it was, yards wide at 1,000 yards range. The shutter can be moved mechanically, so, and if I think rightly, at varying speeds. No, maybe wrong there. When that shutter momentarily, and very momentarily, closes the slot, then that intense light changes to intense darkness, and before the eyes of anybody, even up to 1,000 yards away, have adjusted, it's on again, and it keeps going on and off and on and off and on and off. In addition, there are coloured filters which can be put across the slot, which alters the apparent range of the source of light. And you can imagine, gentlemen, what is the contrast when, we say just for experimental purposes, you put two of these tanks at a set distance apart, so that at 800, 900 yards ahead, the beams overlap. These two fans of light overlap. So you have a triangle of darkness between the two, where you can put anything you want. You can put infantry, you can put gun tanks, you can put flamethrowers. Assault engineers with their specialized equipment, anything. And that, depending on the way the turrets are turned, the spacing of the tanks, that can be a very broad triangle for assembly. It can be moved out, and you can put the tip of that triangle of darkness almost onto an enemy position. A troop, if necessary, a whole squadron of nine tanks. And then the technicalities of learning the controls, of working the generator, and because of the intensity, keeping the two arcs at the right distance, because they're burning down, and they last about 30 minutes. So with very heavy asbestos gloves, the arcs have got to be changed, reset, relit.
How long would that operation take, just to take them out and reset them?
Well, it had to be coordinated with the other tanks, but that was a matter for a troop commander or a squadron commander no point in them all being burnt right down at the same time. So there would be some that had to be changed when they were by no means burnt out, and others could go right down. We were practiced in changing them, but for me, the practice was limited. It was obviously not so intensive as the actual operators within the troops, within the tanks. It was to give me an insight, and the signal officer and various other people, well, to know what was involved and what our buds had to learn to do, but also there might come an occasion in odd circumstances where we might have to do it for real. The time it took, obviously, the time came down with practice, and there was a limit to aim at, but I cannot for the life of me think.
It would be a matter of minutes to do this. Were they difficult to get in and out?
Well, what have you got to do? You've got to... switch off. You've got to open the glass screen. You've got to get asbestos gloves. You've got to, even with these damn great thick ones, although it was geared to the fact that gloves were going to be used, because the mountings in which the carbon rods were held, they had some sort of a lever or reasonably quick release mechanism on them, and you had to get those out. And I've mucked it up already, because you had to get, before you put these damn great gloves on, you had to have the replacement arcs ready in a clip. And oh, my memory. I'm sure it was wheel adjustment. Obviously, the mechanism holding the rods had brought them down as they were burning. So, of course, they had to be reset for a full rod, or two full rods. The glass screen trapdoor clamped shut. The gloves off, dispose of the old ones, switch on the generator, and then wait for the order to light up. I suppose with practice, that could be done in little over a minute. Something of that order. Now, I've talked, I'm troubled with afterthought, aren't I? The eyes and the ears open and the mouth shut, and I do not know whether all that information has been declassified or not. All I know is that I have a book called Tank, and in that there is a section about night fighting. It's a book by Kenneth Maxey, and it gives a diagram of the layout of a CDL turret, in this case mounted on a Grant tank, and he gives details of all the layout, and he mentions CDL, canal, defense lights, mounted successively on Matildas, Grants, and Centurions. Okay, well, somebody else must have had the Centurions. Though only the Grant model aspired to operational status. 13 million candle power arc light is mentioned. Could be focused through a slit in the armor, therefore not as vulnerable as an unprotected searchlight. He goes on to say, as an aid to shooting by night in conjunction with ordinary good tanks, it was unrivaled. But he goes on to say, the concept suffered from over-secrecy because of a subsidiary claim that a flicker device would so blind the enemy that the CDL tanks could not be shot at. In fact, this claim was exaggerated, while the extreme secrecy accorded to CDL made it difficult for frontline soldiers to learn how to use it. So, it would appear, to use a modern phrase, to be in the public domain.